Hey, welcome back. You Never Can Tell, also known as C'est La Vie or Teenage Wedding. Great rockabilly song written and performed by the one and only Chuck Berry. It was actually composed in the early 1960s while Chuck Berry was in federal prison for allegedly violating the Mann Act. I hosted a conference back in November called Follow the Truth, just east of here in Oshawa. And we flew Roswell investigator Don Schmidt up here to make a presentation. And I tell you, he had the 300 or so people who were in attendance that day, and they showed up in the midst of a snowstorm. Don Schmidt had them absolutely mesmerized with his information regarding the crash of two discs near Roswell, New Mexico. And backstage, after his presentation, Don and I were talking, and he was telling me that he's a practicing Catholic and that he's very conflicted when it comes to the possibility of extraterrestrials visiting our planet and interacting with human civilization, and I can relate to that. So now, imagine you're the principal of a Catholic school, the principal of a Catholic school, and you discover that several of your students are exhibiting some very bizarre, very disturbing behavior. And after careful consideration, you're left with a very uncomfortable, equally disturbing explanation. Perhaps these students are victims of an alien abduction. What would you do? We'll find out when my conversation with Victor Vigiani continues here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. My name is Richard Serrett, and up here in Toronto, I'm the host of a little chat show called The Conspiracy Show on AM 740 Zoomer Radio. We also have about 30 U.S. affiliates and counting, the website richardserrett.com. Victor Vigiani is with us. He is a Canadian UFO disclosure advocate. And before we talk about your career as a principal at a Catholic school, I want to talk about some of the initiatives that you're spearheading and supporting, and one of those is this NASA open letter with Edgar Mitchell. Tell me about that, Victor.
Yeah, it's I'm glad you brought that up, Richard, because a good friend of mine, his name is Bill Wickersham. He's an adjunct professor at the University in Missouri in Columbia, and he and I, he apprised me of the fact that NASA and the Library of Congress were having a symposium on preparing for discovery of extraterrestrial life. And it sort of tweaked his interest, and it tweaked mine. And we sort of said, well, what's it all about? So we watched the symposium through the website. And we found out that basically it was just a charade, basically, a complete charade regarding extraterrestrial life. And it dealt with microbial life and the possibilities that if we found, insects or microbes that might be existing on some faraway planet. And that was the sum total of the 2 days of this particular symposium. And Dr. Wickersham and I, we decided to develop a response, and we did that. We developed a response. We called it unacknowledged evidence. In other words, the stuff you didn't deal with, guys. And we wrote up about a 10-page response critiquing in a very positive and professional way the entire symposium, and then we provided them with the whole realm of evidence. And you can see this on our website, on the website blog of Zealand Communications. You can actually read the letter and the response to that. And we were very fortunate in getting the support and co-signing of Dr. Edgar Mitchell and Paul Hellyer. When I emailed Dr. Mitchell, he said, "Victor, you have my complete support. And put my name on the letter," because he knows full well that the kinds of things that NASA and the Library of Congress are doing are just a basic front for the kind of exposure that the ET question is getting or not getting in the mainstream media. And they have literally thousands, if not millions of dollars behind them, whereby, our news agency, Zealand Communications News Network, has just my wallet behind it, which is, right now contains about $70. And so we're trying very, very hard to get the news out in a professional manner, and we challenge the Library of Congress and NASA to come forward and really look at all the evidence that we're providing. So that's one of the initiatives that we're trying to put forward. And one of the other ones, in addition to the support that we gave you in the Follow the Truth, and we really enjoyed being there, was the Modern Knowledge Tour. It's a tour by two Canadians that are really doing a whole lot of hard work on purveying this information right across Canada. They went on a tour from Halifax to Vancouver last summer, and they're doing another one. And if anybody wants to look at that information, it's called the Modern Knowledge Tour .ca. So those are just three of the initiatives that we're following, and we hope that that this one particular one to NASA comes up with some sort of response. We've yet to get one because I think that what the Library of Congress is doing is just sitting on information, not really doing anything about it, much like the media.
And if people want to read that open letter to NASA on your Zealand News Network website, where do they find it? Where do they go?
They would go to the blog, the news service blog, and it's Zealand Communications, all one word, .blogspot.ca. And they can scroll through the number of press releases. They can actually read the press release that we announced, and then they could go within the press release. There's a URL that they can click on. You can read the entire open letter to NASA and the Library of Congress.
All right. Tell me about your tenure as a Catholic school principal. Was that here in Toronto?
Yes, it was. It was. I spent 35 years as a in the system, the Catholic school system here in Toronto. 28 of which was in administration. And towards the end of my career, the second last school that I was appointed to, a situation developed that was rather difficult to deal with. And the way it started was, just to provide a bit of context to people, at the time I was still doing that radio program that I alluded to earlier, Strange Days Indeed with Errol Bruce Knapp. And many of the people, teachers, friends of mine, they knew that I was doing the program and talking about UFOs on a regular basis, and it was sort of common knowledge, and it really wasn't a big deal. And it was mostly tongue-in-cheek by the people who I worked with, and yes, that's fine, just let Victor go on and do those kinds of things, and it won't bother anybody. However, my work in the abduction field, dealing with other adults, took me into an area while I was principal at the second last school that I was appointed to. One day I was sitting in my office, and I watched a car pull up, and the car pulled up, and it was about 9:30, quarter to 10, late, and a little boy got out of the car and ran towards the front door. He was late, and I recognized the little fellow, and I'll call him Tommy for lack of a better name. And he ran in the front door, and I met him at the front door because I knew Tommy looked very unsettled, and he was a very difficult child to deal with. And at that point, I saw him come in the front door. His clothes were all disheveled, and he had a lunch bag in his hand that was, you know, sort of gripped at the top, and it was sort of wet and damp, and he was clutching it. And he looked very, very agitated, Richard. So I knew that being grade two, this little boy, you know, grade, you know, 7 or 8 years old, I did not want to let him go into the classroom in that kind of upset state. So I brought him into my office and said, Tommy, you know, come on in, sit down, and we'll just sort of relax and before you go to class. So we sat down in a chair in my office, and we sort of relaxed, and I did a bit of paperwork while he was there. And I said, Tom, you look like you haven't had any sleep. You look like you're just sort of, you didn't sleep at all. He said, no, I didn't sleep at all. I didn't sleep at all. He was very disgruntled. I said, you didn't sleep? He said, no. I said, why didn't you sleep? What's wrong? Why didn't you get a good night's sleep? And then at that point, he sort of stopped fidgeting and becoming agitated, and then he stopped. And he looked right at me, Richard, looked me right in the eye, and he said, "They came back."
They came back.
That's what he said. They came back. And I really did not know what to make of it. I really had no idea where he was going with this. I said, "What do you mean they? Who came back? What came back?" And he said, "The little monsters." So I'm just sitting in my chair trying to get a grip on myself. I said, little monsters, okay, like little kind of, you know, hairy monsters that are under a bit. No, they're little gray monsters with big eyes. So I took another deep breath, and I tried to make sense of it all. And knowing full well that there's no way that I could possibly delve into this with this child, because as soon as I did, I would be, you know, opening myself up to all kinds of possible negative repercussions from the people that I worked for, because you just don't do that.
Sure.
Especially in the context of my background. So I probed a little bit, and I said, little monsters, what did they look like? Did they have large eyes and pointy chins? I said, okay. And knowing a little bit about where he might be going with this whole thing, I said, okay, well, how did they get into your room? And he said, well, through the window. I said, well, yeah, do they, you know, open the window and climb in? He said, no. He's being very deliberate now at this point. He said, no, they come through the window, sir.
Mm-hmm.
Through the window, okay. Then I became totally, you know, nonplussed about the whole situation. And I said, well, what did they do when they came through? Well, I saw the orange light, and they came through my window, and they stood around my bed. And that's as far as we got with the conversation, Richard. At that point, I ended the conversation. This is as far as I could go with it. And I brought him back to class, and that was the last conversation that I had with the child about it, because there was no way that I could have pursued it. Now, what happened as a result of Tommy's tenure at my school, he had some very serious family problems, and I was brought to court by the Child Advocacy Program in Ontario, because there were some abuse issues with the family, and eventually Tommy was removed from his home because of situations that were going on at home. So this was a boy who had some very, very serious problems, but he saw it necessary to share his experiences with me.
And I'm guessing that there was a pattern that you had observed. I mean, this wasn't just a one-time thing where, you know, little Tommy showed up late and he was a little agitated and talked about these monsters coming through his bedroom window. I mean, was there a pattern here that you had sort of were able to connect over the course of weeks or months or years with Tommy?
Yes, he was very problematic in his behavior. He would there's a, you know, aggressive behavior. There were some analysis of his background, and we found out that there was a fetal alcohol situation involved in it with his parents, and just a lot of really serious learning difficulties. Although when he was assessed as a high functioning child. This was not a boy who was in any way intellectually delayed at all. He was a very, very intelligent little boy, as all of the tests proved to bear out about this young fellow. So he was a very smart little character. So he knew how to express himself, but he was very manipulative, and he was very aggressive towards children. So there were signs that this child was challenged in a very in a multiplicity of ways in dealing with reality, and this is one of the expressions of it. And you know, maybe I'm making assumptions about what would really happen, but from that that incident, I was really struggling, and I had been in conversation with Dr. John Mack, who most of your listeners are probably aware of. And I was in conversation with John about a lot of different things regarding the abduction phenomenon, and I mentioned this to him. And he was very, very disturbed about it, and I explained it to him in exactly the same way I just explained it to you. So we decided to get together. So I made my way down to Harvard University in 1996, I believe it was, during that summer. And I met with John twice about this and described the whole situation to him. And he and I both were convinced that with all the evidence that this child was being authentic in relaying his information about his experiences.
And so you were convinced, and Dr. John Mack was convinced,
yes,
that
was.
Little Tommy was, in fact, a victim of an alien abduction.
Yeah, that was our conclusion. And you know, a lot of people will say, well, it was just transference or abuse issues. In opposition to that point of view, my take on it, that there was no way that a child of that level of intelligence could confabulate that kind of information. He would have lied about other things, and Tommy was not a liar. It was one thing that I would know, that if you asked Tommy about something, he would give you the straight up goods. So it was something that was real for him. It was something that was authentic, and it was something that he chose to share. He could have talked about it in any way he chose, but he chose to characterize it in a very, very similar way, as other children have and as other adults have, in a very similar way. And there's no way that he would know that kind of information from any other source.
You must have felt completely helpless.
Pardon me?
You must have felt completely helpless. Here, you know, you suspect this child as being tortured, essentially. Yeah. Never mind, you know, the potential abuse problems at home.
Of course.
At the same time, this child is being, perhaps, abducted, and you can't act. You can't do anything about it.
My hands were tight. And that's exactly what John Mack asked me. He said, Victor, what is your political capital? He didn't quite understand the question at the time. And I guess what he meant was what kind of political gravitas do you have at the school board to bring this forward and say to the administration that, you know what, there's just something might be going on with some of our children in our school board that you're not really recognizing. And so at that point, I had to make a decision whether or not to begin raising the issue with my superiors that, you know what, there just might be, out of the 96,000 children in our system, there could be a certain percentage, if the percentages are correct worldwide, there could be a large percentage of children in our school board that are experiencing these things but just have no outlet to talk about it. And if they do talk about it, they're just sort of, denigrated and criticized as being just sort of watching too much television. So it was a very difficult position for me to be in, and I chose not to go forward with it for the sake of my own career because, you know, I had a family to support, and I did not want that kind of criticism foisted upon me. Although John Mack was the one who did that to himself by coming forward with his stand against the Harvard board in his publication of the book Abductions, and the way he stood forward and said, "I'm not backing down on this." Regrettably, I had to.
Any regrets?
No, not really, Richard. To be really honest with you, it was an untenable situation at the time. Knowing what I know right now, if I had to do over again, I really don't know what I would do. At this point in time, if it happened to me right now, I would go for it. But at the time, I don't know, maybe I was too naive or to not take upon the challenge of doing something about it.
Were there other Tommies that you suspected during your tenure as a principal that you suspected may have been abductees?
School, yeah, at the same school there was one other boy in grade 6, a little bit older, who expressed and did some very deliberate artwork, some beautiful artwork about his time in forests. Sitting by trees and having large UFOs land beside him and have creatures come out of it. And he also expressed this thing, a very bizarre experience about watching television at his bedroom and the television screen going blank, you know, with the snowy features to it, and him being able to see through those snowy features to his aunt and being able to talk to his aunt with regards to different things that were going on in his life. And we talked about it a couple of times, but he just shared it with me through some very brief conversations and through some of his artwork. And once again, I had to choose to rescind myself from that because I just could not become involved in it. And as soon as I would, I mean, just picture the situation when, you know, you're in your office with two parents and the principal of the school says to the parents that, I think there's a possibility that your child is experiencing alien abductions.
Can't imagine, Victor. Listen, hold on. We'll continue this conversation on the other side. Richard Serrett sitting in here on Coast to Coast AM. Hope you'll stay a while. Hey, welcome back. I don't know about you, but I love it when the Rolling Stones cover Motown. And Ain't Too Proud to Beg, which was originally recorded by The Temptations, and I believe that comes from the Rolling Stones about 1974, which would be the It's Only Rock and Roll album, if memory serves. And it rarely does. We are speaking with Victor Vigiani, UFO disclosure advocate up here in Canada, talking about his tenure as a Catholic school principal and encountering several students in his charge that he suspected may have been victims of alien abduction. But there's much more to tell with Victor and his efforts to disclose the truth about UFOs and ETs. And we'll also, at the top of the hour, we'll open up the phone lines and take your calls. But when we come back, I want to talk to Victor about another initiative that he spearheaded. This goes back to 2010. You may recall that author Robert Hastings hosted a conference at the National Press Gallery in Washington in which a number of U.S. military personnel testified that they had witnessed UFOs tampering with nukes. And you would think that that would have caused quite a stir in the national media. And perhaps, not so surprisingly, it was met pretty much with stony silence. Well, Victor took it one step further and actually put this question about UFOs tampering with nukes to the then chair of the Subcommittee on Counterterrorism and Intelligence, U.S. Representative Peter King, a Republican from New York. We'll find out what happened when Coast to Coast continues right after this. Victor, before we talk about UFOs and nukes and your efforts to put Representative Peter King's feet to the fire, I just want to revisit again your work with abductees. And we were talking about these young students, and you were somewhat powerless to help them. But I know that throughout your career that adult abductees have sought your counsel. How difficult is that to deal with? It must be an incredible burden.
Yeah, to say the least, Richard, it was, and it was totally inadvertent the way I became involved with several adults in this way. It began basically with just small meetup groups and, you know, getting together with the odd group of people sitting around chatting, and eventually some of the people within the group would express their feelings or their need to talk about their experiences. And I guess because of my background, I have a counseling background in sociology and conflict management. It's almost endemic to my nature to kind of want to know more and perhaps allow people to, those kinds of individuals, to feel safe in talking to someone about it, because generally speaking, my experience with most of the people that have had these experiences, all they want to do is talk about it. And they want to kind of delve into, you know, why it's happening and what does it mean to them, and to somehow relieve themselves of the victimization that they feel about it. Because they can't talk to anyone at the workplace. Most of them are criticized. Even within their own families, they can't talk about it. So it's very, very difficult for some of these people who have these authentic experiences to actually talk to someone who's non-judgmental about it. And using my skills as in counseling, I was open to that. I felt that it was something that I needed to do, that I wanted to do, and that I could do. And it was something that very beneficial for these individuals. But like anything else, it's truly sort of incisive and very deep within the persona of individuals. It becomes very stressful, not only for the person who has had the experiences, but for the person who's listening to it and having to either provide explanations or some sort of comfort to the individuals that are going through it. And that I found very, very stressful. And it became almost a burden at some point, because all these people want to do is talk and talk and talk and relieve themselves of the burden with someone. And for the most part, most of them were serious individuals who could deal with it on a real authentic level. But there were certain individuals who just couldn't handle it, despite whatever kind of assistance I could give to them. So I was getting calls in the middle of the morning, you know, at 2 or 3 in the morning, and I want to talk to you about this. I need to talk to you about that. I need to talk to you about my just totally compelled and very, very demanding in their way of wanting to express their feelings about it. So it was something for me is, you know, don't want something too much. You just might get it. And that's exactly what I got. I got a lot of pressure, a lot of, forcefulness on the part of some of these people because of the compelling nature of what they were going through. And eventually, Richard, I just had to back away from it because it was something that I just couldn't handle anymore, to be quite honest with you. And it was something that I brought to a halt. And unfortunately, it's just something that I've got to deal with myself and go on from there, because it did become very difficult for me.
You had sort of hinted at, or we hinted at, a childhood experience for you. Can we just delve into that briefly? Because I think
Yeah,
that's sort of important to the whole story
yeah,
of who you are and how you arrived at where you are.
yeah. It happened, and I suppose I was probably about maybe 11 or 12 years old, and I'm from a family of five boys, Richard, and we lived in a small bungalow in North York, in Toronto, and there was the room that we were in. It was two sets of bunk beds, one set, another set where we were sleeping. I was on the top bunk of one of these of one of the beds, and it was a relatively good sized room, but it had a door, and I was sleeping, and so if I were to raise my head, I could look straight out the door and see what was going on. Opposite was the stairwell to the downstairs, and to the left of that was the washroom. And one night, as I recall it, I woke up, and for whatever reason, I didn't know what it was. I sort of raised my head from the pillow and looked down because I was on the top bunk. And as I looked down, and for whatever reason, I don't know why I woke up, and as I looked out the doorway to the bedroom towards the stairwell to the basement, I saw a figure, a small figure, draped in a kind of a cloak, very small, probably 3 to 4, 3.5 feet tall. With sort of a round cap on, with like a rounded hat with a cupola on it, and a brim. It was all rounded, and it was very dark, and the cloak was like a brown, blackish brown, and it was floating. The end of it, the creature was floating by, walking past my bedroom towards my mom and dad's bedroom. I saw one of them go by. And I saw a second one go by, and then I saw a third one go by. I saw three of these, whatever they were, pass by the doorway. They didn't come into my room, they didn't do anything, but they passed by my room, heading towards the back of the house where my mom and dad were. And I remember doing reality checks. You wake up, is this a dream? Is it, what am I hallucinating? I didn't know what was going on. I was 11 or 12 years old. I had no clue what was going on at all. I had no idea that this phenomenon even existed at that time in my life. And that was it. That was the end of it. I never consciously, that I can recall, having any other experiences like that. But that was very, very real to me. And it stands out in my mind as an authentic experience that I will never forget.
You're a practicing Catholic. Are you? I mentioned Don Schmidt in a conversation we had. He's a practicing Catholic, and he's conflicted about the whole extraterrestrial issue and what it might mean and how that squares with his faith and the narrative that's laid out in the Bible. What about for you? Does this present problems for you? Are you conflicted?
Not at all. I don't. In one sense, in the context of how we were brought up, I guess Don and I probably are about the same age, approximately. So we were brought up in a very similar context, and the way we were brought up was very straight and narrow, as Catholics. But as I grew older, I began to understand that the way the church was portraying its philosophy was pretty strident. And at a very early age, probably in my mid-20s, I began to question some of the things that were going on in the church. And there were elements here in Toronto, segments of the church who, at the Newman Center that I was part of, we began exploring different aspects to our Catholicism. And we began to realize that the church that we knew and respected and loved was in fact a very, very different church, and there were other scenarios and other ways of engaging your spirituality. And from that, I learned a lot. I learned a lot to how to understand how the story, the biblical story, and who this person Christ was, and how he manifested himself, portrayed itself in a real way to each individual. And my sense was that I eventually got to the point of admitting to myself that the Catholic Church was on the wrong path. It was becoming too strident in its belief system, and I had to back away from it. Being a very spiritual person, it was easy to do, but being someone who was engaged in the church, it was very difficult. But right now, my whole understanding of what this extraterrestrial issue is, in a lot of ways, has a lot of resonance with what the church believes and what the church told me. But it's just a different way of telling a different story. And so my understanding of the whole ET issue is that this is a very spiritual thing. It's a very exoconsciousness kind of thing. It's plugged in. You're plugged into it in a very different way. So your belief in a creator, your belief in the one, is not necessarily bound by your Catholicism. It's bound by your spiritualism. And that's how I've been able to accept the fact that we are being engaged by civilizations that aren't from here and that perhaps have a contact with the Creator in the same way that I do, but I just don't understand their contact, and maybe they don't understand mine or ours, and there's some resonance that eventually will come into play that we'll both understand how we interpret who the Creator is and who this person Christ was, and then come to some sort of understanding about what the ET issue means in a very huge universal cosmic sense. So there is a connection there, and I'm convinced the Catholic Church understands this issue, but it's just not manifesting itself with the information about it. The Church knows a lot more about this issue than they're saying.
You have a brother that's a Catholic priest, correct?
Actually, he's a Christian brother.
A Christian brother?
Yeah.
Do you two talk about the UFO ET issue?
Oh, quite frequently, yeah. Yeah, quite frequently.
Any common ground there?
Initially, when I first mentioned it, my brother was very reluctant to talk about it. But in our conversations, he's beginning to understand the idea and doing some reading on it. I know that he has. Is that there is this aspect of spirituality that's contact beyond our own planet. That there are entities out there. There are spiritual beings. There are other kinds of beings out there who are part of creation. And that's the idea that resonates most strongly with me, and I think with him. Whoever these beings are, they are part of creation. They are part of our evolution. And in some way, shape, or form, they form a part of our belief system. And unfortunately, I think the Catholic Church did decide way back to make it a very strident belief system, whereby right now with the current Pope, with Pope Francis, I think that's beginning to open up a little bit, and the Church is beginning to understand that people need to know what the Church's position is on the extraterrestrial issue. So they are leaking information out about this, and I think my brother recognizes this, and there is a bit of common ground there.
I want to talk for a few minutes about Robert Hastings, mm-hmm. and his book UFOs and Nukes,
right.
Extraordinary Encounters at Nuclear Weapons Sites. And back in 2010, he hosted this a press conference at the National Press Gallery in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, set the stage. Tell us a little bit about what occurred at that press conference. And then I want to talk about your efforts to sort of follow up on that with none other than the chair of the subcommittee on counterterrorism and intelligence, U.S. Representative Peter King.
Yeah, essentially, I think it was in September of 2010, Mr. Hastings came forward with Robert Salas and with the documentation of, I think, six other launch commanders, that they all had some sort of experiences with UFOs, some kind of craft of unknown origin, engaging in incursions over the airspace in nuclear weapon facilities. This one, the particular one that Robert Salas was involved with, was in 1967, I believe, at Malmstrom Air Force Base, where up to 12 nuclear weapons were put into a no-go situation, and the guards up on top reported a large UFO hovering there. Robert Salas, being one of the launch commanders at the time, received a telephone call from these security people up there watching the UFO. What should we do? Should we fire upon it? He said, no, just sort of hold your position. He hung up the phone. They called back again. They were screaming and yelling and saying that this UFO was hovering and they didn't know what to do. And eventually the UFO just took off in a blink of an eye. And then just after that, 12 missiles were shut down. And what Robert Hastings did, along with Robert Salas, is present this at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., which is a very a tremendous, if people want to look at it, all they have to do is Google Robert Hastings and the Washington National Press Club press conference. It's a very, it's an excellent, excellent thing to watch, and Robert's done a great job. So from that, what happened, and it's a very kind of difficult situation to describe. In concert with Robert Salas and a Catholic priest who lives in New York, and as an aside, this Catholic priest, and one of the reasons why I am convinced this whole issue is real, not just the missile issue, the entire issue of the UFOs, is this Catholic priest knew very well, before he became a priest, knew very well as a friend, Rumsfeld, Donald Rumsfeld, the former Secretary of Defense of the United States. They were educated together, and one night they had dinner, and this Catholic priest asked Donald Rumsfeld, and he asked him, what is this whole UFO issue all about? And Rumsfeld looked at this at the priest and said, I've never lied to you before, and I'm not going to lie to you now. And that's all he said. And both the priest and I took from that Donald Rumsfeld knows exactly what's going on.
So in other words, I can't say anything because I'd have to lie, so I'm not going to say anything.
Exactly right. And we've talked about this a number of times as to why Rumsfeld said this to him. And so we are both convinced that this is, for me, it's a personal smoking gun regarding this. So in essence, like getting on with the conversation regarding the House Intelligence Committee, we decided, myself and the Catholic priest and Robert Salas, develop a briefing document. And we sent the briefing document to Congressman Peter King, who was at the time the chairman of the Homeland Security Committee in the House of Representatives. And we sent him all of the documentation from all seven of the launch commanders from that had the experience. So we sent this to him along with a covering letter, and we demanded that he respond to this. And we went through a series of communications with all of his staff, namely Michelle Ingerson, his legislative assistant, and his media representative Kevin Fogarty. And I spent time on the phone with Michelle Ingerson, explaining to her the importance of this issue. We sent to her the documents. She assured me, and I have all the documentations, that Peter King did in fact receive the issue, the briefing. Whether he read it or not, I don't know, but he did receive it. And we got no calls back from Kevin Fogarty at all. It was just a deadline. I left a number of, I've got it all documented with each and every single telephone call that I made, both to Ms. Ingerson and to Kevin Fogarty, as to how they were presenting this information to Peter King. So we know for a fact that this did reach the desk of Peter King, all this documentation about missiles being shut down, numerous missiles being shut down. And there was absolutely no response to by him at all to us, other than the fact he sent me a very generic email saying that I did receive your correspondence. I get many calls, and it's basically a generic response that he would send to any one of his constituents. And the reason we sent it to King, because the Catholic priest involved is a constituent of Peter King, and Peter King would only respond to constituents, not to someone else like Robert Salas or myself. So he had to respond. So in fact, we know that King did receive this. Now, the downside of this story is during the whole congressional hearings that were held, the citizen hearings on disclosure back in...
Let me just get you to hold on to that story, Victor. We'll follow up on that. We'll take a time out, come back, and we'll also take some calls. Victor Vigiani, Canadian UFO disclosure advocate, executive director of Zealand News Network, back with more here on Coast to Coast AM. My name is Richard Serrett.